Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics podcast from The Times. I'm Matt Chorley. This is a special edition of the podcast recorded live on Facebook at just after midday on Friday, the 9th of June 2017, as we all came to terms with the outcome of the general election. Goodness me, this is not what we expected. We've got a hung parliament, still one more seat to go. Kensington and Chelsea are taking the afternoon off and they'll get back to their counting, but it currently stands that the Conservatives have 318 seats, Labour 261, the SNP 35, Lib Dems 12, Green 1, and others lumped together 22, but we'll dig into those because some of those matter far more than others. I'm joined with a stellar panel by Alice Thompson, columnist for The Times, Emma Tucker, deputy editor of The Times, Patrick Kidd, sketch writer from The Times, and Tim Shipman, the political editor of The Sunday Times. Welcome to you all. If you are watching on Facebook, you can post your questions underneath the video and we'll try and get through as many as possible. And we've already had some which have been sent in already. So we'll start nice and straightforwardly. Matthew Knowles on Twitter says, who won? It seems like everyone lost. Who wants to start with that? Alice.
I think Ruth Davidson actually is one of the real winners of last night. She was utterly extraordinary in some ways in the way she ran a very nice campaign and she was very upbeat and she also won a lot of seats in Scotland. And compared to Theresa May, she did look as if she'd been efficient and effective and she hadn't called the election, but she'd done very well out of it.
YouGov, I think. I mean, we were talking about the polls and saying someone's going to have egg on their face and someone's going to look really good. And despite YouGov being the Times pollsters, I think between ourselves we thought no. And they were doing this seat-by-seat analysis. And they were saying things like Kensington is a toss-up. And people said, no, can't be, no. And here we are. They were saying Canterbury. I remember Ian Dale tweeted, if you want to know how rubbish the YouGov poll is, they're saying Canterbury will fall to Labour. It did. So, I mean, they put their reputation on the line and all credit to them for that. So they've had a good night.
Philip Hammond, potentially, who was being brutally knifed by sources close to the Prime Minister last weekend. I may live to regret saying this, but it seems unlikely he's going to be moved as Chancellor.
I mean, we're not big on political predictions now, but his position certainly looks more secure than it did yesterday. It,
very much so. Yes, and you know the Home Secretary, who's probably the other star of the show on the Tory side, is managed to cling on to her seat with a majority of 300, and any chances she might have had of taking over from Theresa May have gone up in smoke as a consequence. You can't have a Prime Minister who might be removed from her own seat.
Emma?
I think it's too much of a stretch to say that Remainers won, but I think the hard Brexiters lost last night. And so I think, you know, the bets are you know, all this talk of a hard Brexit, no deal, better than a bad deal, I think that's going to end and we're much more likely now to get a more nuanced approach to the Brexit negotiations when they happen.
And so what do we think is going to happen with Brexit? Because as Theresa May kept telling us in the election campaign, the talks start in 11 days. And if she lost only six seats, Jeremy Corbyn would be the one doing the negotiations. Well, she lost more than that. And they do still start in 11 days. So what's going to happen?
Well, I think it's inconceivable that they can start in 11 days. But having said that, the messages that have come out of Brussels this morning have all been, it's all, you know, let us know when you're ready, but the clock is ticking. Which really, really puts a pressure on whoever
the egg
timer
has been turned over.
What was extraordinary about the election was that Brexit didn't get discussed enough. So actually, we haven't discussed it for so long that we're now going to have to catch up and start discussing it quite seriously. I think
we got a bit near the end when Boris was unleashed and gave a Brexit speech, and they'd forgotten about it for a couple of weeks, and they didn't play enough Boris. I mean, he's been perhaps another winner because certainly among the Tory grassroots, there's clamour for him now. He's not going to be sacked.
Betty Chesterfield says, does Mrs May have a mandate to represent us in the Brexit talks? I do not think so. I mean, that's part of the problem, isn't it? She laid out, supposedly, her Brexit plan, and she can't claim that the country has rubber-stamped it. What do you think, Tim?
No, but she does have more votes and more seats, and in our democracy that does count for something. Yeah. I rather suspect they will try and trot off in 11 days and at least kick things off. There may well be a debate about precisely... what we're offering, and David Davis's comments last night suggest that there is room for some nuance and manoeuvre, as Emma was saying, and I think, you know, potentially they may try and broaden things out and bring in some other people and suggest that they're listening to groups that they've been ignoring for some time. I wouldn't put it past Theresa May to make some bold offer to the other parties to join the negotiating team and make Keir Starmer, you know, part of the gang. They may well not go along with that in the Labour Party, but it at least puts the choice back on them.
Well, in fact, Sadiq Khan.
Liam Gladdy on Facebook says, do you think there's a chance that the Conservatives will seek a Brexit coalition with Labour, send Starmer and Davis to start negotiations while we sort this mess out?
Well, I don't think that's impossible. And if you look at the positions they've got, if you take the politics out of it, they're not a million miles apart. Labour says that they want to secure, you know, the equivalent of single market access. Well, Theresa May's position is that she wants to secure the most of that she can. And in practical terms, those positions aren't terribly different. Where the difference comes is that they, you know, the Tories say that controlling immigration is more important than that, and Labour say it's the other way around. But in terms of can we go and get the best deal, that may not be the worst option.
And in terms of selling whatever deal emerged from that, having the two main parties, you know, if they both had a stake in it.
Well, if they've both dipped their hands in the blood, then, as the phrase goes, that would be more difficult, which may well be why Labour might reject such an offer. But it seems to me that it would be a sensible one for Theresa May to make at this point.
I can't see why Corbyn would take it. He has come out and said she is an illegitimate Prime Minister. A ridiculous thing, by the way, that Labour are 65 seats away from being a government governing party and they're claiming they've won the election. But that's by the by. But he has effectively said she has to go.
I think we can forgive Jeremy Corbyn for being a bit pleased with himself.
He's had a very good election.
We thought we were going to see the total destruction of the Labour Party, and instead he's won.
Matt, you started by saying none of us thought this was going to happen. The trouble is, if you're in a household of younger people, they're not surprised by this result. Despite, you know, I've had people bending my ear at home saying you're out of touch. Look at my Facebook forums. You know, Corbyn's going to do really well, and I dismissed it completely and said, "No, that's not scientific." I do feel that one of the big stories to come out of this election is social media and the effect it's had on the vote,
and also the rallies. So actually, when you looked at Jeremy Corbyn, people did turn up to those rallies.
Yeah, the festival generation.
We should have looked at that. They were really going for it, and they all enjoyed it, and they liked seeing him. And that old-fashioned campaigning combined with Facebook was a sort of bizarrely.
And how much of an impact do you think the complaint that the young didn't turn out for the EU referendum last year, and the sort of grievance that appeared to, you know, the young didn't turn out and the older people had ruined it for them and all that sort of stuff.
They clearly
felt much more motivated for this.
My children, it was more that they just quite like what Jeremy
was
saying,
which is actually quite
positive. It wasn't a negative, look, we're going to show you. It was more you know, we read this and we think it looks quite fun and it's actually addressing us and people are interested in us finally.
I think the young were taken for granted, absolutely taken for granted by Theresa May. She offered them nothing. There was nothing that she offered anyone.
She offered no one anything.
Yeah. But, you know,
being offered nothing was an advantage out of the Tory manifesto. I'd have taken nothing.
I want to say, because it will get bleeped out, but as I had in my sketch this morning, a former Tory MP said to me, Theresa May had to have a better pitch to the middle classes than to say Labour will kill you, we will only bleep you.
Yeah.
And that's what her pitch was, you know. Yeah. We will do you over.
Yeah, it didn't
work. She wasn't exactly helping the elderly. That was the weird thing. Neither the young or elderly did work at this
at all. So as Tim
says,
who exactly was she offering anything
to? And then it was interesting that the narrowing of the polls, which everyone assumed would boost the Tories because it raised the real prospect of Jeremy Corbyn becoming Prime Minister, actually that seems to have really invigorated Jeremy Corbyn supporters, where it suddenly became a realistic thing. Let's go out and make this happen. There was a big sort of rallying cry.
Which is why it's very dangerous for the Conservatives if they think about calling another election, because now that the Corbyn generation has got this close to the hem of power, they've got every incentive to turn out in even bigger numbers next time.
So let's take another question. Somebody says, Ed Johnson on Facebook says, is there any alternative to May being Tory leader, or is she only staying because the alternatives are also so poor?
Well, I think it's more a case of the process of putting any of those people in would be so disruptive that it would probably end up with Jeremy Corbyn in Downing Street. And the after a lot of rage overnight, which most of us will have been getting in our text messages and WhatsApp queues from Conservatives, most of them are waking up to the reality that if they try and change their leader at this point, the whole thing is going to go into total meltdown. And the alternatives... You know, David Davis looked like the person who would probably inherit if she had literally fallen under a bus. But he's being blamed for persuading Theresa May to call the election. Not everybody in the Parliamentary Conservative Party thinks that Boris Johnson is the answer to all questions.
But might this make her, I mean, it's a weird question, but might this make her a better leader?
Well, I mean, what we've seen in the last month would suggest that the only way is up.
Also, she's got to do something about Downing Street. So you can't have Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill both dominating in the way that they have. And so far, she hasn't really said anything about that. But, I mean, it has been extraordinary, hasn't it, that you've had this knife-eye situation where, you know, you actually basically, you know, if you can't get to Nick and Fiona, you never get anywhere. And it's all done through them.
And we had a chart in Red Box this week which showed that Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill had more press than two-thirds of the cabinet in the last 2 weeks of the campaign. I mean, obviously not all of it positive, because some of it was to do with the social care thing, but the fact that I had to sort of remind myself who half the cabinet were.
Yeah.
And they're the ones who went out and did the heavy lifting, and I imagine the tone of the conversations between Downing Street and some of those cabinet ministers is going to change.
There was a lovely line on that a couple of days ago. Ed Vasey was on the Daily Politics and was questioned about Philip Hammond going AWOL. And he said, well, no, he'd seen your list, I think. He said, this shows that Philip Hammond was the third most mentioned cabinet member in the media. And Andrew Neil said, yes, that's because we were all asking, where is he?
Yeah. Or whether he's about to be fired.
Which he now probably isn't.
Again, a story that could have been put to bed if Theresa May, standing next to him, had simply said, yes, this man is my Chancellor of the Exchequer. Those stories ran because they didn't close them down.
But even weirder, though, that the story wouldn't have got off the ground if they hadn't organised a press conference with nothing to announce. To put the Prime Minister, the Chancellor, in a room full of journalists with nothing to talk about other than whether or not she was going to sack him.
Yeah, not even the deficit.
No. Mm-hmm. Amazing. Somebody, Tom Burgess on Facebook says, how would the Conservative manifesto slash future policy be affected by a partnership with the DUP? So the way that Theresa May gets over the magic 3-2-6 is by having 10 DUP MPs supporting her. They're already on board, we think. Who wants to volunteer anything about DUP policy?
Well,
it's expensive, is the first thing you need to learn.
Shiny motorways.
Traditionally, close votes in the House of Commons have cost the sitting party about £1 billion for DUP support. So one can imagine what having their support constantly will end up costing.
And the DUP, they're quite big on the pension triple lock, I think.
They like the triple lock.
They don't like...
They like a lot of
retiring
sort of
too late.
Infrastructure investment. Which we've not seen a huge amount of from the Tories, rather more from the Labour Party.
But they're also more in favour, again, on a soft Brexit, because they're very worried about the border. So although they voted for Brexit, I think, they're not pushing for a hard exit.
Well, a couple of people. Sue Leedham says, what hope does this give to Remainers? Nadine Waddle says, as a Remainer, I was hoping that a hung Parliament means a softer or even dreamily no Brexit at all. The trouble is she started the clock ticking before we had the general election.
And there's a lot of legal confusion about whether you can actually revoke Article 50. I mean, it was never meant to be triggered, let alone triggered and then revoked. So I honestly think no one actually knows whether or not you can suspend it, overturn it, pause it.
There are these 48% of people who actually, I think, behaved quite well after Brexit. We kept going on about the majority spoken, but actually it was such a tiny majority. And actually, I think quite a lot of people did wake up this morning who were Remainers, feeling slightly, actually we've got our own back. Then could we actually possibly conceivably do something with this vote? And I think maybe they will want to. I think it is wishful thinking, I have to say, but I think there will be quite a lot of people who think, can we just get back to normal, please?
Business will weigh in now as well. They'll feel emboldened to say more than they were saying. They'd all gone a bit quiet.
So you're watching the Red Box podcast live on Facebook. Post your comments in your comments and questions in the comment section underneath. I'm joined in this studio by Alice Thompson, Emma Tucker, Patrick Kidd and Tim Shipman. Let's take another question. Ben Cohen, who I think is from Pink News, who manages to get a plug in.
The rugby player.
He says that the Pink News Awards are happening on Wednesday the 18th of October in Westminster. And they invite lots of MPs and Lords to it. Is our event going to be held in the middle of, or worse still, the night before another general election? He's managed to get a plug in there and basically say, are we going to have an autumn election?
Not another one!
Straight to Brenda.
Where is Brenda? I thought so 3 hours ago, and I don't think so now, because I think the Tories have realised that that would bring them total disaster.
It depends how it works with the DUP. We talked, I'm not supposed to mention this just before, you said 3-2-6 to win votes, but you take the Speaker out of that, you take Sinn Féin out of that, the Deputy Speakers. I mean, Theresa May actually only needs one or two extra MPs to vote with her. Now, obviously, there will be illnesses and stuff, but this takes us back to the 70s, where we saw that very good play not long ago, where both sides were wheeling in their sick and dead and to try and get over the line. And actually, you may find she doesn't need DUP support on quite a few things if she can have discipline among her backbenchers.
But given that the reason she called the election was because she felt she was going to struggle with a majority of 12, saying she might be able to muddle along with a majority of minus 2... doesn't sound that promising.
Well, she's going to need to do the things that some of those Remain MPs wanted. She's going to have to make a much more explicit pledge that whatever she comes back with from Brussels would be put in all circumstances to the House of Commons. She hasn't quite said that yet. There are lots of things where she did not concede full ground that she might have conceded ground on before, and she's going to have to concede ground on now.
Also, we're not going to get some of the manifesto pledges, hopefully. So there are quite a lot of issues like fox hunting, which took up 700 hours
grammar schools
last time, the grammar schools, faith schools. There's a lot of different issues, and you know, free school meals, whether or not she'll be able to get much of that through. And maybe that's what the electorate wanted. I mean, I think quite a lot of the electorate didn't want the manifesto, which is, you know.
Well, so David Rising says maybe this is a vote to say not politics as usual. Maybe it's saying get yourselves sorted out and work together for the benefit of the country, not the party. Is it a sort of... Do the British public always get these things right? They got it right in 2010, 2015?
Well, you could say that, that in a sense they have got it right. They want Brexit, but they didn't want a really hard Brexit. They didn't like Corbyn. They don't particularly like May. I mean, if you look at it, they've sort of got that covered. They've got May, but on condition. They didn't get Corbyn, but they sort of gave him a boost. And it looks like Brexit's not going to go the way that it was heading. So, in a strange way, you could say we've sort of ended up with roughly what the public wants.
They always get what they want in the end. Let's just talk about Scotland, because the decline in the SNP and gains by the Tories and Labour Party and Lib Dems on a scale that maybe we weren't expecting. Was that a surprise?
13 Tory wins. I mean, everyone was saying 10 as a very optimistic and probably thinking 6 or 7. So Ruth Davidson, as you said, has really delivered. And of course, there's the clamour now, will she come down to Westminster?
Well, here we are. Kieran Cochran said, it may be wildly unrealistic, but several people have entertained the fancy of Ruth Davidson riding down over Hadrian's Wall and somehow marauding her way into Westminster politics as the Tory saviour.
They're going to have to improve the sanitation in Parliament, because Ruth Davidson came and spoke to the Parliamentary Press Gallery a few months ago and was asked, as she always is, about this. And her main reason was they don't have good enough loos down in Westminster.
How would they do that? Would they have to give her... would there have to be a by-election?
I thought you were asking about the sanitation.
No.
Well, but there could be a by-election in South Thanet.
I mean, I think she'd want to do it, with
Craig McKinley still being charged, and as a resource, innocent until proven guilty, if she's got a minority government, and that's one that they didn't have to have a by-election...
South Thanet and Ruth Davidson?
Yeah. Or maybe Maidenhead.
Yeah.
Maybe Theresa says, I've had enough of this. I'm going to go and sit in David Cameron's shed.
I don't think South Thanet's safe enough for something like that. I mean, we did an interview with Ruth Davidson in the Sunday Times magazine recently, and she was pretty clear that her future lay in Scotland for the time being. The one thing stopping a leadership election at the moment is the lack of a sort of agreed candidate who could stand unopposed. I have to say, if she had a a seat in Parliament right now, there'd be people trying to drum up support for that.
I think the most important thing is how her campaign was run. So there'll now be a huge argument about the fact that she ran a very different campaign from Theresa May, and whether or not we've had the end of nasty campaigning and negative campaigning and Linton Crosby and fearful and all those sort of things that were very much part of the Westminster campaigning. She doesn't do. She's very open. She's brilliant. You know, she's great on Twitter. She's great on Facebook. She's really good at all that side of it, and she's got a fantastic backstory, and she doesn't do the sort of, you know, Theresa May, the only naughty thing I've ever done is going through a week.
When I went up and saw Ruth Davidson last week in Edinburgh, I was struck by how much she was stressing that it was her campaign in Scotland, and if it went wrong it was her fault, but by implication any credit came her way, and she was trying to insulate the campaign up there from what was happening down south. But I mean, they speak to Scottish Conservatives. Even the past couple of days, they thought that they had been hit by the May factor.
Well, clearly she did succeed in insulating it. It was almost like two different campaigns.
Absolutely. She gets on very well with May, they say. But I'd heard that she was keeping Linton Crosby well away from it.
Interesting.
And also, I went to... Ruth Davidson gave the Orwell lecture about 3 weeks ago down in London, and began by taking the mickey out of the Prime Minister, which I thought was brave. I'll forget the quotation, but she read a bit of Orwell in which he said that the power of rhetoric is that politicians can make powerful arguments out of pure wind, was that fact. And she said, I wonder what he'd think of this election, you know, strong and stable, stuff like that.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
And I thought that was ballsy.
Yeah.
But then she did. But I mean, just after the EU referendum, she came and spoke at the press guy, she had a whole load of jokes about.
Well, there was the massive Johnson that was wheeled out to take the mickey out of Boris.
You know. I can't remember the full details.
No, and but she also is very sort of. She sounds normal when she talks about herself. The other highlight of that speech, and a phrase she used several times, she did one of the debates, and there was talk of having her during the EU referendum on the same side as Angela Eagle, and she made some reference to, she told Sir Craig Oliver, who was then the Tory communications guy, well, you know, that's fine, I'm happy to do it, but do you want sort of two spade-faced lesbians on the same stage? And yeah, you can't imagine most politicians talking about themselves like that.
I found it because it was such a good joke. So she was talking about the differences between the Tory party and the Labour party and how they deal with their leaders. She said, you know, Labour's still fumbling with its flies while the Tories are enjoying a post-coital cigarette after withdrawing our massive Johnson.
Gosh.
No, but that's, for somebody who we're talking about is the only serious candidate to be Prime Minister.
Yeah,
that's
taking it from someone whose worst that was running through a wheat field.
Your job as sketchwriter would be much easier if you had Ruth Davidson as Prime Minister, wouldn't it?
Well, when I did the Orwell thing, I likened her to one of the Bass Street Kids. Yeah. It was just after Leo Baxendale, the cartoonist. Yeah. And did you ever see that wonderful picture during the campaign of Theresa May coming on stage and Ruth Davidson running past her and that was a Bass Street Kid pose,
and she got the crowd really fired up for that. Then Theresa did Strong and Stable,
but she's a caricature, but she is sunshine when Theresa May has been, as my colleague Quentin also, let's call her a glum bucket.
She also has this extraordinary ability when she's actually worked for the BBC and she's been in the army, and you know, she's a lesbian and her parents are very religious, and she's quite religious and she comes from Glasgow, but she sort of speaks very beautifully in a kind of, you know, perceived English. You think it's extraordinary how she manages to balance all that. Mm. So you could either dislike everything about that, or what's happened is we've sort of embraced all of her, haven't we?
And she rides on the back of a buffalo and a tank and whatever.
And she's younger than anyone in the cabinet as well. She's, you know, she's not quite appealing to the youth, but she's...
She's definitely got more appeal to them than Theresa May.
But the striking thing is, on almost every count, her best attributes are the Prime Minister's worst attributes. Mm. And, I was wondering a few months ago when the time would come when they stopped seeing her as an asset and started seeing her as a threat. And
might be the point. Let's have another question. Gillian Humphrey on Facebook says, despite appearances, it wasn't all down just to May. Who else needs to be held to account for this epic judgment failure from the election call onwards?
Well, that's the piece I'm hoping to read in the papers on tomorrow and Sunday. You know, because the blame game started as early as last night.
Yes.
There were people saying that Theresa May, I mean, I don't know if it's true, was already saying it wasn't her idea. Her advisers advised her to do it.
Well, I think almost everyone in government was telling her to have a snap election. She kept saying no. And then eventually she was the one who made the decision. So
I think it's the walking holiday. I think... bad idea.
Blame Wales.
She shouldn't have taken a holiday. I also think Philip May might have something to do with it, because he must have been, as the only other person on the walking holiday, one of the only people that she actually listened to.
But you can't blame her for doing it. I mean, the polls...
No, it was the right thing to do. Yeah. She did execute it.
The campaign was bad, not the...
But even... Well, yeah, I suppose so.
The manifesto was bad. That's when it all started to go wrong.
But we'll never know. It may be that if she had run a brilliant campaign, the same... I mean, we just don't know. But based on what the polls were saying at the time she called it, it was a logical thing for her to do.
The other mistake was calling a 7-week-long general election. And some of us did actually say this the day she called it. It makes no sense as the sitting party to call a 7-week election. Normally you do a quick and dirty 3.5 weeks. You know, there are some limits to how short you can do it based on the Fixed Term Parliament Act. I think it might be 25 days. But it's absolute madness to have a 7-week campaign. You're always going to have a cycle of events, and, you know, there is always going to be a situation where the narrative points to the person behind catching up. And we had that, you know, coupled with two terrorist attacks, which it's fairly astonishing that Theresa May was not able to turn that to her advantage. The whole thing was basically a shambles. But the manifesto is the key turning point, as far as I'm concerned. And that's certainly what I'm picking up from ministers and MPs this morning, that's where they're putting the blame.
That, and it was all about her. You know, we had those rallies with them holding banners saying Team May, people tweeting saying, I'm honoured to be Theresa May's candidate in wherever. And if you're going to run a campaign based on personality, you better have one. And the trouble is, they then discovered that she was the only one they put out. Didn't put Philip Hammond out, didn't put Boris until the very end. And so 7 weeks of May every single day, it's like having gruel for breakfast every day, isn't it?
Theresa May and her team were so desperate to take total credit for this landslide
victory.
They weren't willing
that they didn't concentrate
to share any of that. So it was going to be all about her, and she was going to win it, and it was going to be her victory to do what David Cameron had never managed.
I think Gordon Brown today must be feeling quite smart, because he actually, you know, he's always thought of as having been so appalling in so many ways, but actually at least he didn't call an election. He must be thinking now, well, you know, he must have always thought, should I have called that election? Now he knows it's probably not a good idea.
Well, this is the Gordon Brown result, isn't it? Jeremy Corbyn has got the same result as Gordon Brown, and Theresa May has behaved like Gordon Brown. So.
And while we're on the subject of smug, we should probably talk about George Osborne, who...
Where do we start?
Barely contain himself.
Well, he didn't contain himself.
No, he didn't. That is true. So he was on ITV. I mean, he refused to leave ITV News. They said, you know, we've done with you now and we've got some more guests coming in. And he said, no, we'll stay. And he rode out the rest of the night.
He can barely contain himself, but there must be a bit of him thinking, why did I give up my seat? I mean, I don't know. Wouldn't he be a contender for a leader if he was still in Parliament?
He is the biggest beast in a way on the Remain side. And so actually when he looks at it, and you're talking about Nicky Morgan maybe putting her name forward, he must be thinking, well, she was my deputy, basically, that it could have been me. And that actually if I hadn't gone and got all these different jobs and gone and been editor of the Evening Standard and kept my seat, there would have been a chance of...
But he is loving editing the Evening Standard. Every day there's another titbit in the leader column about...
Yeah, I mean, he was virtually calling for her to resign before we'd had a single result. I mean, he's just been on the radio talking about his front page headline, barely able to contain his laughter. There were quite a few Cameroon parties last night, which friends of mine were at, where Schadenfreude Central was the constituency they were sitting in.
On the other subject of somebody else who's now out of Parliament, Nick Clegg. Although the Lib Dems are now up to 12, they started on 9, they've gone up to 12. but there's been quite a lot of churn there.
Well, it's a sort of almost an entirely different parliamentary party, isn't
it? John Pugh was going anyway, but his successor in Southport lost. Clegg's gone. There's been a couple of others, haven't there? But then we've got the big beast back. We've got Vince back. We've got Ed Davey, Joe Swinson.
You have just used the phrase Ed Davey and big beast in the same sentence, but we'll let you off.
Sir Ed Davey,
if you don't mind.
But Vince will want to be a future leader, won't he?
Yes. Well, Vince loves always being a future leader. That's his. That's how he likes to operate.
Norman Lamb staying on in North Norfolk is interesting because his Tory opponent was very close to Team May. Had worked with Nick Timothy closely before, was married to the leader of the House of Lords, local boy, and that was a clear decapitation strategy there and didn't come off.
So what state are the Lib Dems in now? Because we did think, again, that they were sort of heading for disaster.
Well, they've got fewer votes than they got last time, which is a pretty astonishing achievement, actually. I would think Tim Farron will find a dignified way out at some point, and I would think Joe Swinson is actually the one who will end up taking over rather than Vince Cable. They'll try and at least look to the future. But it's been a curious campaign for them, because it looked a week ago as if they'd made completely the wrong arguments by hammering all this Remain stuff. Actually, it looks like they might have been onto something. Unfortunately, all those people have gone and voted for the Labour Party instead of for that.
I'm curious about to what extent this the outcome reinforces this sort of cultural divide that we saw post-Brexit. You know, with London was an amazing story last night. I mean, I don't know how many Tory seats there are left in London now, but, you know, the Labour vote increased massively. And so, you know, this split between the capital and the rest of the country seems to have been reinforced. And I'm just wondering whether that sort of city versus rural cultural divide has been, or, you know, university towns has somehow been reinforced by the outcome. By the result.
But it's rather extraordinary that it is Kensington that's going Labour. Yeah. I mean, if it does go Labour, it is really bizarre, considering they are the richest constituency
An immensely Brexit MP, or candidate, Tory candidate, who was wearing a Union Jack Alice band on the day of the Brexit bill being passed. And that's how to sort of troll your constituents.
But I mean, Diane Abbott's had about the worst campaign of anybody, and her majority is now 35,000.
Brown says, what I'd like to know is who is going to congratulate Diane Abbott on her 35,000 majority and apologise to her after the terrible racist and misogynistic campaign waged against her?
Well, OK, I'll apologise to Diane Abbott for nothing at all, I'm afraid. I mean, well done on getting an enormous majority, but, you know, you're judged on your performance during the campaign. I've covered 5 general elections now, and I don't think I've ever seen a front bench spokesman quite so out of sorts as dear old Diane has been over the last month or so. And it's not about race or sex, it's about incompetence.
I have no doubt that she has received some vile comments on social media, as they get that we racist and misogynist and that's disgraceful. But she is rubbish. And she obviously, to become the first black female MP was an amazing achievement, and she was a figurehead. But to then hold her up as an example of what black women can achieve when she's not actually any good, I think is quite disgraceful and disrespectful to other black women who are extremely competent. And in the Tory party, Tories have elected Kemi Badenoch and Saffron Warden, who is a member of the London Assembly, who is a black woman who's highly regarded. It's not, you know, Labour don't have the control over.
Yeah, the monopoly.
Diane Abbott made some big, big mistakes, and they talk about her having health issues. We can't really discuss that.
But she also made big mistakes during the sort of terrorism crisis. I mean, she was the spokesman on Home Affairs when that was the question we were all asking her. It wasn't like she was doing agriculture or some issue that wasn't actually really important and vital for us to be discussing at that time. She was discussing one of the major issues of the campaign.
When they brought up the fact that she had been a big figurehead in the 80s, and someone pointed out, yes, but you wouldn't put Paul Gascoigne into the England football team today.
Yeah,
he may have been.
You could say that about Corbyn as well. You know, big beast in the '80s, and put him in the hot seat, and he.
The argument about her ill health struck me listening to particularly Barry Gardner trying to explain the situation. Is if she was ill, then why did they wait until the day before the election to do something about it? And if she wasn't, and they've made it up, well, that's even worse.
That's quite cruel on her.
Ill and they were putting her up for these interviews, then they behaved irresponsibly.
But, I mean, people were laughing, but given that she could have ended up in the Home Office today...
Mm-hmm. Well, it'd be interesting to see if she returns to the Labour front bench now. I mean, those of us who have followed this quite closely, I think, have some suspicions that... people at the top of the Labour Party just felt it was convenient to put her out of the way. Maybe they'll think that it's fine to bring her back now. That will be one of the proofs of the pudding on this one.
She's been temporarily replaced by with Lynn Brown, who, from what I've seen in the comments, is arguably a less impressive politician and a bully as well. She was famously told a blind journalist to get the F out of my effing way, which I don't like bullies in public life, but she's not been impressive at the dispatch box. So we shall see. There's going to be some shuffles, of course. Barry Gardiner, you just mentioned, has had a good election. I think Andrew Gwynn
has had a superstar.
I want to see the Andrew Gwynn, Boris Johnson round three. It's like Arlie versus Fraser. You need the third battle to. They've been a really good double act, like Portillo and Diane Abbott used to be on This Week.
Yeah, whether or not you want either of them in the Forward Office is a separate question. Let's do a couple more questions. Kudzi Makopa on Facebook says, with two of the last three general elections ending in hung parliaments, is it time for proportional representation?
I would say no, because actually, going back over what we were discussing earlier, first past the post has an uncanny way of arriving at a sort of crowd-funded version of what the British public actually wants. And if you're a sort of middle-of-the-road person who can see good on both sides of the political divide in this country, if you go back over the last sort of 10 or 12 general elections, most of the time, if not pretty much all the time, the kind of common-sense position has ultimately been arrived at by the great British public. And this time round, they do feel like they don't really want Jeremy Corbyn to be Prime Minister. They're not that keen on Theresa May. They wanted to cut her down to size a bit. We are pressing on with Brexit, but perhaps not with the same kind of Brexit. And that's through a sort of process of elimination is about where we've ended up.
Also, we have had a referendum on PR. I mean, that was the first
referendum.
Well,
in the risk of this, everybody logging off, AV is not proper PR.
No one's true. Yeah, but no one's.
But let's not get bogged down in that.
Yeah. But it was the first referendum, and we didn't go. And actually, that's what kicked off this mania for referendum. Because actually, I think David Cameron, in the end, thought, "Oh, these are quite a good idea. We can just, you know, use these.
We know how to win these.
We know how to win them." Then Scotland, they just about won, and then, you know, that got them into Brexit.
One of the best things about UKIP not coming into government, you can probably think of a few, but one of the best things is they were promising a referendum every other year based on an opinion poll. That they would have a petition.
They'd rule by referendum.
This is the way they get the death penalty back, I think, was the plan. But there would be
a petition. With Paul Nottle, chief executioner.
Yes, whatever got the most signatures, there would be a referendum. They were promising Neverender. Mm.
UKIP...
I was going to say, are we? Is
done?
This it now? Are
Paul
they
Nuttall's
done?
Gone. They,
Paul Nuttall's gone. They didn't,
Farage,
you know,
coming back.
Farage, oh. I mean... I woke up this morning, I saw Farage on television, I thought, I may be wrong, but I suspect this is pretty much the last we'll see. Well, they'll always be there, but they're not going to play a big role now in the future. They've done their bit. They've surely had their say.
They've lost their deposit in something like 330 seats.
And did they? Didn't was their share? Well, their share of the vote,
about
did it 2% go up?
And it was amazing. Yeah. When you saw the breakdown in individual seats, the UKIP purple bar was down massively. And in a lot of seats, it was then evenly split between Tories and Labour.
Yeah.
So although everyone thought, oh, it's all going to go to Tory, actually there was a big...
But that was one of those pre-election sort of assumptions that people made that turns out not to have been
I
right.
wouldn't assume Nigel Farage is going anywhere. At the risk of quoting one of my own tweets, I did say this morning that all elections end with Nigel Farage either returning as UKIP leader or retiring as UKIP leader, and sometimes both.
I saw Gawain Towler, the UKIP communicator chief, said earlier, I've had the honour of serving 9 UKIP leaders and 5 of them were Nigel.
Right, finally, Vanessa Gray on Twitter says, my question is Laura Koonsberg bionic? Does she not need sleep?
Well, it's not just Laura.
It's
what
not
about
just
you, Matt?
Laura.
Come on, Matt.
I've
tell
not
us.
Had any sleep since 5 o'clock yesterday morning. How much sleep have you had, Tim?
I've had 57 minutes and I expect to get 3 more hours between now and Saturday evening.
Patrick,
you can go on better than that.
I've not had any sleep since 6 o'clock yesterday morning. Oh, so not as long as you, but I have
pathetic.
Got a...
Pathetic.
He's got a newborn.
I've got a newborn
got a
baby.
Newborn.
So.
And what about...
I've had a good 3 hours.
Oh...
3.5.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Adrenaline is a wonderful thing, I think it's fair to say, in these situations.
Yeah, I wouldn't have missed last night for the world. It was quite extraordinary, which seems to be what we say on about fortnightly basis. My thanks to Alice, Emma, Patrick and Tim. Don't forget, you can sign up to my morning email briefing, which I do during the week and Tim does on Sundays. It's thetimes.co.uk/redbox. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.